Hello there, and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. We are in the book of Ruth. Yes, a book of the Bible with a female title, which doesn't happen often. And today we're looking at chapters 2 and 3 with this teaching, the Chutzpah of Ruth. Last week we talked about Ruth chapter 1, and we need to review because chapter 1 is essential to understanding what happens in the rest of the book of Ruth. So a quick recap, this story is set sometime around 1200 BCE in a little town called Bethlehem, which is in modern day Israel. It is in Bethlehem that a woman named Naomi marries a man named Elimelech, and Elimelech and Naomi have two sons. The first son is Mahlon, and the second son is Chilion. Unfortunately, then, there is a great famine in the town of Bethlehem, so Elimelech and Naomi take their two young boys across the desert to a country known as Moab. Today, we would call this young family a refugee family, forced out of their homeland because of a natural disaster, a famine. So Elimelech and Naomi are living in a foreign land, raising their two boys when the unthinkable happens. Elimelech suddenly dies. Naomi is heartbroken. She's heartbroken because she is burying her lover. And at the same time, she looks at these two young boys and she is realizing how difficult it will be to raise these children in a foreign patriarchal society as a single mother. And somehow Naomi perseveres. Once her oldest son, Mahlon, is of marrying age, he finds a Moabite woman named Orpah, and the two are married. Then her youngest son, Chilion, finds another Moabite woman named Ruth, and they are married. And at this point, I picture Naomi being relieved. She was able to raise these two young boys in this foreign land and get them to a marrying age. They married, and now all she has to do is wait for her daughter-in-laws to become pregnant. And then she will have financial security for the rest of her life, as well as securing her family name for generations to come. But a year goes by, and there are no babies. Another year goes by, and another year goes by. And both Mahlon and Orpah and Chilion and Ruth are struggling with infertility. This goes on for a decade of waiting and waiting and hoping and praying and feeling the absence of infertility that so many couples feel in our modern society. And after a decade goes by, the unthinkable once again happens. Mahlon suddenly dies. And Naomi, who was forced to bury her husband, is now forced to bury her own son. Orpah becomes a widow. And the tragedy and the heartache in this family grows exponentially. But Orpah and Naomi still have hope because there is another son, Chilion, a brother-in-law to Orpah. Now, this may not sound like a lot of hope to you, but the fact is a lot has changed since 1200 BCE. 3,200 years ago, there were no social security plans for citizens. 3,200 years ago, there were no 401k plans for retirement. 3,200 years ago, women were not viewed as equal citizens to men, but rather as property to be owned. And so when a husband died, it was tragic, but you compound the tragedy by the fact that there's no sons in a marriage, and now there's all of a sudden all sorts of questions about financial security and stability and what's going to happen next to these poor widows. But Orpah has a brother-in-law. She still has Chilion. And the Bible outlined what would be the equivalent of our social security program for widows and what would happen with a brother-in-law. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 5 reads this: "When brothers reside together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her, taking her in marriage and performing the duty of a husband's brother to her, and the firstborn whom she bears shall succeed to the name of the deceased brother, so that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. So while this part is not explicitly stated within the story of Ruth, what we can assume happens is after Mahlon dies, Orpah remarries not just anyone, but her brother-in-law, Chilion. And Chilion then is married not only to Ruth, but Orpah as well. And the whole idea is that Chilion will give Ruth and Orpah sons, and then their family name can continue and have security beyond the life of Chilion. But life does not go according to plan for Orpah, Naomi, and Ruth. Because the unthinkable, once again, happens. And Chilion dies within a year of his brother Mahlon's death. Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth are out of options. And the future does not feel stable, but instead is clouded with uncertainty. Shortly after Chilion's death, Naomi receives word that the famine in Bethlehem has ended. And so Naomi begins the trek back home after a decade of living in Moab. And she brings with her her two daughters-in-law, who are technically her property. And they walk back along the road to Bethlehem, and then Naomi stops. She turns to Orpah and to Ruth and says to them these words, "My daughters, it has been far more bitter for me than for you, because the hand of the Lord has turned against me. Return to your homes in Moab." At first, Orpah and Ruth say, No, we will not leave you alone to die. We will stay with you. But Naomi insists. And Orpah goes and kisses her mother-in-law and then returns to Moab, and we never hear from her again. But Ruth clings to her mother-in-law, and she says to her some vows. She says the words, "I will go wherever you go. Your people shall be my people, your God shall be my God, and I will die where you die." Ruth is committed to Naomi, and Naomi realizes that she is not going to change Ruth's mind. So she allows Ruth to return with her to Bethlehem. Ruth has never stepped foot inside of Israel, and here she is now living as a refugee in Israel without a husband to take care of her. That is the end of chapter 1. And chapter 2 begins the very first morning that Ruth and Naomi wake up in Israel. Ruth turns to her mother-in-law, Naomi, and has a strange request for her. The strange request is this. She says, "Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain behind someone in whose sight I may find favor." Now, this is a strange request by our standards today, but it is a very natural request within Naomi and Ruth's historical context. Because when you read through Scripture, you eventually come to a book known as Leviticus, the third book in the Bible. And Leviticus chapter 19 talks about gleaning. We read these words when God speaks to Moses in the book of Leviticus. God says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall not strip your vineyard bare or gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God." So what God is saying to Moses is God is saying it's not a bad thing to farm and to harvest what you will from the land. But when you harvest and take from the land, when scraps fall down, do not pick them up. Allow them to remain on the ground so that the poor and the alien can come along later and pick them up and have food to eat on their own table. This is a crude form of our welfare system today, but it is a welfare system for the ancient world. If God was speaking to Moses today here in Redlands, California, then I believe that God would say to Moses, when you have an orange grove and oranges fall from the tree, do not pick up all of the oranges. Instead, just harvest from the trees, and if you ever drop one, leave it on the ground. Later, those things that have dropped, will be available for the poor and the alien, so they can have food and oranges to eat as well. To pick up the scraps for the poor and the alien is what we call gleaning. And so Ruth turns to her mother-in-law, understanding what this foreign religion and foreign culture has as a welfare system, and she asks for Ruth's permission to go into the field and participate in that welfare system. Now, because Ruth does not have an Israelite husband, she is technically an illegal refugee living within the country of Israel. She doesn't have any rights whatsoever. But here we have a story about an undocumented immigrant going on the welfare system. And this is not a story of condemnation toward people who go on the welfare system. Instead, it is an affirmation and a declaration that their perspective is in fact holy and essential and must be remembered by people of all incomes and citizenship statuses. So Naomi hears Ruth's request and gives her her blessing. Now, this blessing must have been hard for Naomi because the field was a lot less regulated than the town. The field wasn't really a safe place because stuff could happen out there. And much like our society today, unfortunately, the man would be believed over the woman just about every time. But at the same time, Naomi doesn't have a lot of options here. So she gives Ruth her blessing and sends her out into the field to glean. And so very early in the morning, Ruth goes out to work the fields as a gleaner. And instantly, people around her begin to notice how much of a hard worker Ruth is. So much so that within a few moments, Boaz, the man who owns the land that Ruth is gleaning on, shows up. And when he shows up, he sees Ruth gleaning among the field, and his first question is not a very romantic question, but it is the question he asks. He turns to one of his aides and asks the question, "To whom does this young woman belong?" Very male, patriarchal kind of answer there. And the aide responds to Boaz by saying, "Oh, that is Ruth the Moabite, the daughter-in-law of Naomi. She was working incredibly hard here as a gleaner." Now, when Boaz hears the name, he immediately goes over to Ruth for a very specific reason. Boaz tells Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women." He then goes on to tell her about how he has instructed the men of the field to keep an eye out for Ruth and ensure her safety and well-being. Now at this, Ruth is overwhelmed by Boaz's generosity. She ends up falling down face first on the ground and she asks him a question. "Why have I found favor in your sight, Boaz, that you would take notice of me when I am a foreigner?" Now, it's here that a lot of male preachers get this story wrong. Because often they'll say, "Well, we all know why Boaz was so nice to her, because she was something good to look at." But Boaz cites another reason for his generosity. Boaz tells her about how he's heard a story about her. He says these words in Ruth 2:11. He says, "Ruth, all that you have done for your mother-in-law, Naomi, since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and your mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. May the Lord reward you for your deeds, and may you have a full reward from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." The reason Boaz walks right over to Ruth and offers her protection and kindness is because he is inspired by the way that she treated her mother-in-law. I find this fascinating for a number of reasons. The first one is that there is a bit of a stigma. There's a bit of this feeling that women today should not get along with their mother-in-laws because it is impossible. And that there is this sense that women should be rivals with their mother-in-laws more than sacrificially compassionate toward their mother-in-laws. The second thing I find fascinating about this is just how our society has accepted that you can make fun of your mother-in-law and trample on who she is whenever it's convenient for you because it's a punchline that works. But here we have a story where Ruth gives one of the highest levels of commitment to another human being in all of the Bible, and it's her mother-in-law. And rather than people making fun of her for it or telling her that she shouldn't be so close to her mother-in-law, they turn to her and they say, "We are inspired, Ruth, by your loyalty and your commitment to Naomi." And it reminds me that we can be inspired by people's relationships with their in-laws. Now, you may have a difficult relationship with your in-laws, but to you, I would say you can always talk with language of respect, even when you have difficult in-laws. And the respect that Ruth shows for Naomi is nothing short of inspiring, not only to me, but to Boaz, one of the central characters in this story. So after Boaz offers Ruth this protection and says, "You can always glean in my field," he then leaves, and Ruth continues to work. The sun continues to rise. You can imagine that Ruth begins to sweat, and her hands begin to get bruised and calloused from working the fields all morning. And just as the sun is at its highest point, everyone breaks for lunch, and Boaz comes over. He finds Ruth once again, and he invites her to eat lunch with him at his circle. And so Ruth, the foreigner, the refugee, enters into the circle of the owner of the land, and she sees that before her and before everyone in this circle, there is a generous amount of food ready to be eaten. Now, may I remind you that Ruth and Naomi are hungry, and they have been driven places because of famines, and to see this full meal is probably the first time that Ruth has seen this much food in a long time. And so Ruth begins to eat, and she eats a lot. And we read how much she eats, is she eats until she is satisfied, the book of Ruth says. But it gets better because there is leftover food, and she is told that she can bring the food home with her. And just when things can't seem to be any better on her first day here in the field, as she gets up to leave, Boaz turns to his other workers sitting inside of his circle, and he says these words to them. He says, "Let Ruth glean among the standing sheaves. She no longer needs to pick up from the scraps. She can go into the places we haven't harvested yet, and she can take whatever she would like." The equivalent here in Redlands, California would be Boaz turning to his workers and saying, "Let her pick from the trees. She does not have to pick oranges up off the ground." Ruth is overwhelmed by Boaz's generosity, and Boaz is inspired by Ruth's compassion for her mother-in-law. So Ruth gets back to work, and she gleans and she harvests from the standing sheaves. And we read in Ruth 2:17, "So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley." Now, an ephah of barley is the equivalent to 2 weeks' wages for a male worker. This is an enormous amount of food. And I picture Ruth going back to Naomi's hut or house or wherever it was that they were living and walking back just being overwhelmed by the weight of the food she is bringing back. And I picture Naomi sitting there waiting. There is no texting. There is no cell phone. There's no way that she can check in and see how Ruth's first day on the welfare system, aka the job, is going. And you can picture Naomi just thinking to herself, "I hope nothing bad happens to Ruth." And then as the day turns into darkness, she sees a shadow on the horizon, and it's Ruth carrying a lot of food with her. And Ruth places all of this food before her mother-in-law. And just yesterday, there was so much uncertainty, and now they have 2 weeks' worth of food in one day. And I picture Naomi starting to cry as she says, "Where did you go?" And Ruth says, "I went to the field of Boaz." And this is when the story changes for Naomi, because she says, "Oh, he's a relative of ours." And then she says, "Blessed be Boaz by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." This is a big deal because just in the previous chapter, in Ruth chapter 1, Naomi changed her name to Mara. Why? Because Mara meant bitterness, and her heart was filled with bitterness, overwhelmed with bitterness, because she had lived through a life where she buried a husband and two sons. And so in Ruth chapter 2, at the very end of this chapter, Naomi begins to feel hope again. The bitterness starts to melt away. That night, Ruth and Naomi eat a meal, and they eat until they are full, and it is good. This brings chapter 2 to a close. Chapter 3 begins with talking about the end of the harvest season. So we assume that Ruth, for several weeks, got up early in the morning, went out to the field of Boaz, gleaned among the standing sheaves, and returned to Naomi with a burgeoning amount of food. And so this goes on and on, day in, day out, hot sun beating down on Ruth. And toward the end of this, Naomi begins to recognize that something has to change. Ruth cannot do this forever. So Naomi says to Ruth, "My daughter, I need to seek some security for you so that it may be well with you." And it's here that Naomi comes up with a plan. This plan revolves around something known as the threshing floor. Now, the threshing floor revolves around the practice of winnowing. Now, before this teaching, I had no idea what winnowing was, but winnowing is this process of separating the grain from the stalk and the husk of barley. So harvesters wrapped up the harvest season by taking stalks of harvested barley and smashing them against the rocks. This would separate the stalk from the husk of barley. Then they bring cows in to trample the husks, which would break up the husks and allow the grain to be exposed. Then the harvesters would pick up the exposed grain that was mixed with the husks, put it in a basket, and the husks were very light while the grain was much heavier. They then tipped the basket over in a place that had a consistent breeze, and the breeze would take away the husks while the grain would fall straight down to the ground. This separation of the husk from the grain is known as winnowing. And all it requires is a spot with a consistent breeze that's outdoors. This all takes place at the threshing floor. So because the harvest season is at an end, there is a bit of a festive atmosphere, as the only process that is left is this winnowing process, which is much less labor-intensive than harvesting. So Naomi says to Ruth, "Ruth, I want you tonight to change out of your widow's clothes, to put on your finest clothes. And when you change out of your widow's clothes, that will signal to everyone else that you are ready to be married once again. Then you are going to go under the cover of darkness to the threshing floor. There will be a great ceremony there, and the men will be drinking, and they will not be drinking Martinelli's. They'll be drinking the real stuff. And once there is that festive atmosphere, just wait for it to die down, stay under the cover of darkness, and watch where Boaz goes to sleep. Once Boaz is sound asleep, then Ruth, here's what I want you to do. Go and uncover Boaz's feet and lie down. And after you have uncovered his feet, he will tell you what to do." Now, if a woman uncovering a man's feet sounds a bit sexual to you, I will tell you that you are not alone. A lot of people believe that this is a sexual innuendo, which is definitely possible. But we must also recognize that this is strictly innuendo. And the author of Ruth never explicitly states whether something sexual is either implied or later happens. And so there is the chance that Ruth was to go and literally just uncover his feet. I read one commentator who suggested that her uncovering the feet of Boaz at a place like the threshing floor, which has that strong, consistent breeze, would immediately wake him up. And that's all that Naomi was asking her to do. So you may have a viewpoint that she was asking her to do something sexual. You may have a viewpoint that she was not asking her to do something sexual. But it's important for us to both acknowledge that the Bible never explicitly states or denies that Naomi's request is sexual in nature. So Naomi says to Ruth, go and uncover Boaz's feet and lie down, and then Boaz will tell you what to do. Ruth hears this plan and responds with very simple words. She says, Naomi, all that you tell me, I will do. That evening, Ruth puts on her finest clothes. She wears perfume, and she goes out to the threshing floor in the middle of the night. She watches as Boaz parties and then says his goodnights to people as he goes to lie down, and Ruth's heart begins to race. Once she is sure that Boaz is asleep, she stealthily and quietly walks across the threshing floor, stands next to Boaz, leans down and uncovers his feet, and then lies down next to him. Boaz all of a sudden wakes up. He looks over. He cannot see because it is so dark, and he asks the question into the darkness, into this form that is next to him, who are you? Ruth responds quickly by saying, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin. For a man to spread his cloak over a woman in ancient Jewish society was for a man to propose to that woman. Not only that, but when she says, spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin, she is reminding Boaz of that verse we referenced at the beginning of this podcast that asks a brother-in-law to marry his brother's widow. And so she turns to this relative and she says to him, spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin. Now, if you're listening closely, you understand that Ruth here is breaking away from Naomi's plan. Because Naomi told Ruth, go and uncover Boaz's feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And Ruth responded by saying, all that you tell me, I will do. Except for the fact that Ruth doesn't do that. Instead, she just jumps over the hurdle and says, you need to marry me. She proposes to Boaz. This is important for all of us to understand because Ruth does not wait. And as we heard in the intro to this podcast, Kelly talks about how one of her major frustrations, how men hear this story, they tell this story, and their main principle is that women need to wait. But Ruth doesn't do that. Ruth doesn't sit around and say, oh man, I hope Boaz proposes to me. Ruth proposes to Boaz. This is a huge deal. And to give you an idea of how big of a deal this is, I want to tell you about my own experience with this matter. All the way back in 2008, I met the most fascinating, wonderful, insightful, hilarious, and enjoyable human being I have ever encountered on this planet. Her name was Kimberly Dawn Primero Tangunin. And within a few months of us meeting in 2008, we began to date. I couldn't believe that she actually said yes to going on dates with me. And so we went all over the place. We went to the Getty in LA. We went to Ben Folds concerts. We went to Mammoth and went hiking. We went on a half marathon, which only happened once because running sucks. And then we spent our first Valentine's Day together in the Sierra Nevadas. While we were sitting at dinner over Valentine's Day, I remember thinking to myself, it doesn't get any better than this. I need to propose to this woman before she figures out that I am the fraud that I am and that she is way too good for me. So the very next month, in March of 2010, I hatched a plan. I talked to her friends ahead of time. They planned a day down in San Diego. And her friends generously offered to drive her to a place called the Salk Institute, which I believe is the most beautiful building in the entire world. My wife and her friends walked out of the car. They got to the Salk Institute, and there's this long courtyard that opens up toward the ocean. And I was there waiting for Kimmy. Kimmy got out of the car. She began to walk down the courtyard of the Salk Institute. And she sees me, and she yells out from across the courtyard, "What are you doing here?" She then started walking toward me. I met her halfway. I reached for her hand and walked to the end of the courtyard. I got down on one knee, and I said, Kimmy, will you marry me? She didn't respond right away, which was a bit of a frightening moment. And I'm sure it was only like 20 seconds long, but it felt like 20 minutes. And after pausing for 20 seconds and thinking about her future, which is, you know, a fair amount of time, she then smiles at me and she says, "Yes, yes, I will marry you." And it was one of the happiest days of my life. Now, as you heard this story, you may have thought, "Oh, that's nice," or "Oh, that's sweet." Or you may have thought, "Oh, it's Craig talking about his wife again," which, you know, I understand. I really like this woman, so you've heard a few stories about her if you've listened to this podcast. But I have a question I'd like to ask you. What if I told you this story and everything was the same except for the end where it was Kimmy who was waiting for me at the Salk Institute? And it was Kimmy who got down on one knee, and it was Kimmy who said, "Craig, will you marry me?" How would this story shift in your mind if Kimmy proposed to me? Now, while most modern men and women would say, "Oh, I'm totally fine with that. You go, girl. Girl power. I am fully on board with Kimmy proposing to her man. I wouldn't hold any judgment against you, Craig." There is this sense that some people might say, "Yeah, I'm supportive, but what was the problem, Craig? Why didn't you propose? Were you a little scared of commitment?" And while the population of the United States of America is nearly 50% male and over 50% women, the fact is, when it comes to heterosexual couples, 95% of the time, it was the man who proposed to the woman in a married couple. Only 5%, one out of 20 couples, are a story where the woman proposed to the man. And marriage has changed a whole lot in just the past couple of decades, hasn't it? We're getting married much older, and we're also not getting married in churches. We're almost all getting married outdoors, which was unheard of not too long ago. But the one marriage tradition that's really stuck is this idea that in heterosexual couples, men propose to women. And if I would have told you this story and said, "Well, it was Kimmy waiting at the Salk Institute, and it was Kimmy who proposed to me," you would have thought to yourself, "Wow, that's some girl power. That is progressive. That is innovative." And I tell you this story with this twist as to what actually happened, because the fact is, in our society, a woman proposing to a man in 2018 is progressive. It's forward thinking. It's about equality rather than tradition. And there are days that we read stories from the Bible and we think to ourselves, "Man, that is backwards. That is stuck in the past. That is old fashioned." And then we read a story like Ruth, where Ruth is told, "Just sit and wait for the man to tell you what to do." And Ruth says, "Yeah, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to propose to him." And this story of Ruth is incredibly progressive, not only for its day, but it is progressive for our day 3,200 years later. It's incredible to me. And the whole reason it's progressive and powerful and insightful and inspiring to us today is because Ruth doesn't wait. Ruth says, "I'm not going to allow a man to shape what I want. Instead, I'm going to own what I want. I'm going to talk about my desires, and I am going to ask Boaz to marry me so I can live the life that I want." And it's here that we have to ask a question. What is it that pushes Ruth to break just about every cultural norm and religious law and end up proposing to a man in an ancient world? Well, I think whatever it is that pushes Ruth in that direction is the same thing that pushes a woman who is alive among us today, a woman named Michaela DePrince. Now, Michaela grew up in Sierra Leone, which is in West Africa. And when she was born, the country was torn in two by a civil war. When Michaela was just 3 years old, her father was killed in the civil war. And a few months later, her mother died from starvation. And at just three, Michaela was forced to go live in an orphanage. While at the orphanage, Michaela bonded with one teacher in particular, But shortly after arriving at that orphanage and bonding with this teacher, the Civil War caught up with the orphanage. Some rebels invaded the orphanage, and they slaughtered her favorite teacher right in front of her young eyes at the age of 3. The person who killed her favorite teacher then turned to Michaela and stabbed her. And it was at that moment that Michaela thought to herself, as a 3-year-old, I really wanted to die. I didn't see the point. I didn't think I would have anything good in my life at all. So some new teachers were brought in to oversee the orphanage, and they were cruel. To give you an idea of how cruel they were, Michaela had a skin pigmentation known as vitiligo. Now, vitiligo is a pigmentation that causes the loss of skin color in blotches. So from head to toe, Michaela has spots all over her body. And these spots were viewed within her culture as being evil or as a sign of being accursed. And so at the orphanage, she received the nickname from her teachers that she was the devil's child. And so these guardians who were supposed to look out for Michaela kept referring to her as the devil's child. Not only that, but they ended up numbering all of the kids at the orphanage. And there were 27 kids at the orphanage, and they were numbered 1 through 27, and the numbers corresponded with the likelihood that they would be adopted. So number 1 at the orphanage was the most likely, number 2 was the second most likely, all the way down to number 27. And the number 27 they gave to Michaela de Prince. As a 3-year-old, she understood what was going on, and she knew that no one wanted her. Michaela, at the age of 3, went through some of the worst evils and sufferings this life has to offer. But when she turned 4, things started to change. There was a very windy day that started blowing a lot of trash around Sierra Leone. And all of a sudden, a piece of trash ended up at the orphanage, and Michaela looked down and she saw something she had never seen before. It was the cover of the May 1979 issue of Dance Magazine. And on the cover was the picture of a ballerina. Now, Michaela had never seen a picture of a ballerina, and she looked at this ballerina and she was captivated by this image. She remembers thinking about it. It was not just the fact that she's a ballerina, it's that she looks happy, and I wanted to be happy. This picture was so inspiring that Michaela folded it and kept it in her underwear because that was the only place they could have personal possessions in the orphanage. Not only that, but Michaela found a friend at the orphanage, number 26, who was a young girl named Mia. And so Michaela and Mia bonded because it was so unlikely that they would be adopted. But then all of a sudden, Michaela heard the words that Mia had found a family that wanted her and that she would be taken away from the orphanage soon. But when Mia's parents showed up to adopt her, they then turned to Michaela and they said, "We've decided to adopt you too." And so Michaela and Mia went with their brand new parents and put the orphanage behind them. Michaela, on the plane ride back to the United States of America, turned to her new adopted mother and pulled out the picture from her underwear. The picture of the ballerina, and she gave it to her mother and she said, "I want to dance like her." Now this, you can imagine being overwhelmed with emotion as an adopted parent, can't you? Here is a girl that you have just brought into your family, and she somehow, through all of the pain and evil she has seen, still manages to dream and to hope. So immediately, Michaela and Mia's mom put both of them in dance class, and Mia remembers thinking to herself, "I was going to have a good time. You know, this is dance class." So I was laughing and goofing around, and Michaela kept getting mad at me. She kept saying to me that I needed to focus and that this was serious. And from day one, Michaela took her ballerina lessons extremely seriously because she promised herself that if she ever got out, that she would give it everything that she had. And so Michaela was laser focused from day one on becoming a ballerina. And so the years went by and the teachers were continually impressed by Michaela's progress, and she kept getting better teachers. And as she continued to grow, she kept taking more and more lessons. Her skill and her craft began to improve. And she remembers the obstacles she faced. It wasn't all just roses after she got out of the orphanage. She remembers a story when she was 8 years old that she told NBC News. She says, "When I was 8 years old, there was this one teacher who said to me, 'You know, we don't put a lot of effort into the black ballerinas because they all end up getting fat and having big boobs.'" So Michaela now is encountering racism, and she says, "I will not allow that to define me." She switches teachers, and she continues to develop her skill until all the way when she's age 17 and she begins to be invited to perform in Europe. And then at age 18, she lands her first job that she can support herself and her livelihood with her dance passion. And that job is at the Dutch National Ballet in Amsterdam. And 4 years later, we arrive at today, where she is now just one step below the highest level and the highest honor in the Dutch National Ballet that she can be. Not only that, but she's landed an endorsement with Jockey, where her vitiligo is exposed, and the whole ad campaign is to show him what's underneath, to value and accept your body in a healthy and positive way. And if that wasn't enough, Michaela received the ultimate marker of success within American society today. She was featured in a Beyoncé music video. In the visual album of Lemonade, during the song Freedom, Michaela DePrince is featured as a dancer, and she choreographed her own dance. And it is breathtaking. And when asked about how she finds the strength and the will to keep going in the face of just overwhelming pain and struggle from which she came, she responds by saying, "The only way I could survive was to prove everybody wrong." What is it that pushes Michaela DePrince forward to break just about every cultural norm and succeed at the highest level? Because whatever that is, it's got to be the same thing that pushed Ruth to propose to a man in an ancient patriarchal society. And this thing, that thing that pushes both Ruth and Michaela DePrince, is something that is inspiring, and it's something that is beautiful, and it's something that we should all strive toward. And that thing was described by another woman who I had the privilege of hearing speak just last week. At All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, I heard Anne Lamott speak. And at All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, she was being interviewed. And the interviewer was asking her about how she overcame some of the greatest trials of her life, her own addiction, her son's rebellion and his addictions, and the feeling of forsakenness, and how she somehow has the audacity to write about hope in the midst of overwhelming suffering. And she responds by saying, "The willingness comes from the pain." Oh man, I remember just sitting there and hearing her say those words, and it was like she named something that was in my head that I've been trying to name for years. The willingness comes from the pain. The laser focus that Michaela DePrince has on dance comes from the pain of her life in the orphanage. Now, please do not hear this and view this as a sentimental or hollow view of suffering. I by no means would tell you that the suffering that Michaela DePrince viewed and held and felt as a young girl makes all of this worthwhile because she's such a great dancer. I would never attempt to justify pain or evil, especially towards children. But that iron will that Michaela DePrince demonstrates whenever she dances grew out of the pain that she experienced. The pain did not define her life forever. She still grieves what she lost, but at the same time, the will that came out of that was stronger than anything she faced before. I believe it is the same with the story with Ruth, where she has to bury her own husband, where she has to bury her brother-in-law, where she has to live in a house that never had a father-in-law. She's held Naomi as she has wept. These two women know so much pain in this world. And when she sees an opportunity to overcome that pain, to live a life that has more security, to live a better life, she's not going to sit around and allow a man to decide whether or not she gets that. She will put it all on the line and propose to a man. Why? Because the willingness comes from the pain. And when we talk about the story of Ruth, we must always remember that the story of Ruth is a story about the strength of the feminine spirit and the feminine will. Yes, there is discrimination. Yes, there is heartache. Yes, there is the patriarchy. Yes, there is oppression. Yes, there is pain, but the willingness comes from the pain. And the story of women throughout history is that the spirit, the will, has always risen above the pain. And so do my sisters who are listening to this podcast. May I encourage you, in the midst of hopelessness, in the midst of pain, in the midst of uncertainty, to continue to push forward, to continue to have the audacity to hope, to continue to believe that you can shape your own reality rather than allowing men to shape it for you. If you have been told that you need to be silent, continue to speak, continue to be who you are, and continue to stand up in the image that God has created you to be. And to my brothers who are listening to this podcast, may we be better. May we celebrate the feminine voice. May we embrace and respect what femininity has to offer our society and ourselves. We must get better at celebrating and respecting the feminine will, spirit, and voice. May we never forget the story of Ruth is a story about the strength and the beauty and the inspiration of the feminine spirit and will. May you see and embrace Jesus Christ in all.